Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes. This is Zero Point Radio on BBS Radio. With me here, I have James Moffitt. Jim, how are you?
Very well. How are you, Chris?
Okay. We got another two-hour show lined up. We haven't even discussed it ahead of time, but we'll, I'm sure, find something interesting and provocative to speak about through our discussions. Jim, any thoughts? How are you?
Well, I'm well. I've been working away at the problem of God's contracting universe, the book I'm writing about your work and its response to Dr. Carl Sagan's claim that as science advances, there seems to be less and less for God to do, and that's the term I apply to the totality of your work. It's your title, actually, from one of your earlier works that you don't use anymore, and I've been working a lot on that. I've been reviewing the zero-point teaching recently. It's very interesting material. Of course, that's the focus of the show. And I actually, later on in the show, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, if I might, just as part of my research.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things here. You were looking at the book, the Zero Point Teachings book?
I was reading the Heart Doctrine specifically, but I was looking at some of your other work, but I was focusing on the ideas taken from Madame Blavatsky and the Secret Doctrine about the zero point and your explanation of how that applies to the origins of consciousness.
Good, because that was the one subject I had mentioned I'd come back to today, is taking some of Blavatsky's references to zero points.
Yeah.
To look at, so that's good. So we'll explore that today. You've been working away at the problem of God's contracting universe.
Yeah.
That just to refresh people who may be new, that was based on a quotation from Carl Sagan, where he says, as we've learned more and more in modern science, there has been less and less for God to do. That as science has advanced, there's been less and less reason to invoke God or metaphysical realities to explain the phenomena of nature. So back in, he wrote, I guess Broke His Brain was 1989.
Oh, no, it was 76.
Broke His Brain was?
Yeah, it was
76. Oh, yeah, 76.
Yeah.
Wow, that long ago.
Yeah, 30 years. That's over 30 years.
Yeah, so I began at that time to kind of pose that question, like, is that right, what Carl Sagan was saying, that as science has advanced, there's less and less for God to do? And I guess I would answer one of the fundamental questions or responses to that is, firstly, I think the debate in modern times between science and religion is largely fanciful. Like, it's not pinned down to theoretical issues. Like, people discuss the issue of science and religion, but they don't know what scientific ideas there are in religious teachings. So they don't see, so religion is portrayed like it's a characterized, it's like a straw man. It's easy for the scientists to debunk the book of Genesis because it seems purely fanciful. But scientists don't really understand what the mystics are saying, and they don't really understand how what the mystics have said are relevant to the issues of science. And one of the things we try to explore here is the profound parallels between mystical teachings and modern science. So I would say in many ways, as science has advanced, it's supported, for instance, the Secret Doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky. Like, just to give an example of this, in Stephen Hawking in 1984 said that most people in the 18th and 19th century believed the universe could always have existed in the current state. So people had no idea back at that time about the origin of the universe. Whereas back in 1888, a century earlier, Blavatsky described creation out of a void plenum, this realm of nothingness or primordial substances. And she described creation from a point source, from what I call a zero point, that there's a first point of differentiation. In science, that's called a singularity. And Blavatsky described going from a point, she said, it balloons into what she calls the dropping of the world egg. So it's like it goes from a point, it blossoms out or and condenses into the world egg. And then she describes that world egg expanding then when the breath of the Father is upon it. So she described the universe going from a point to something the size of an egg and then expanding space-time. And Blavatsky then described that after 7 days of Brahma, 7 days of creation, the universe eventually will contract back to a point source and back into the primordial root principles of creation. So back in 1888, Blavatsky was describing ideas which really are most contemporary. The idea of vacuum genesis, creation out of the void plenum of the quantum vacuum, the idea of singularity creation, creation from a singularity point, the idea that the universe could eventually contract back into a singularity point, which is predicted by the secret doctrine. Blavatsky also said the fundamental tenet of the secret doctrine is that there are infinite numbers of universes being created over eternity out of the root principles of creation. So it's foolish for us to think ours is the only universe that ever has been or would be. Instead, Blavatsky says there's innumerable new universes over the course of eternity. And again, we have that idea in modern science because scientists think now that, well, yeah, there is no reason to think we're the only universe. There could have been other space-time bubbles that were created that or might emerge out of the quantum vacuum. So there could be many, many universes, and there's no reason simply to limit it to one. Blavatsky also predicted a seven-dimensional hyperspace, and she calls it the seven-skinned eternal parent space. So for Blavatsky, this seven-skinned eternal parent space is equivalent to an ether, or it, in modern terms, could be referred to as the zero-point fields. So this parent space is like this hyperspace which underlies what appears to be four-dimensional space-time. So in modern theories, they have what in modern string theory, in some models of string theories, there are seven higher dimensions compacted at each point in space-time. So that's why it's sometimes called 11-dimensional KK theory, Kaluza-Klein theory. So it postulates 11 dimensions. There's the four large dimensions of space-time, and then there's the seven higher dimensions, which are compacted and exist at every point. So modern physics has this model of an 11-dimensional universe, and in ways that's quite compatible with Blavatsky's view, because she regards any created universe, any sun, or any four-dimensional space-time as emerging out of the seven-dimensional hyperspace. And Blavatsky also says when creation happens, there are seven inside and seven outside. So in this teaching, there creation has seven dimensions to it, and often those are regarded as sevenfold again. So in Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, there are said to be 49 planes of existence. So that's 7 times 7. So the idea is that reality is not continuous, but it's quantized. And it's quantized not in any arbitrary way, but there's this sevenfoldness to it, that there are seven discrete levels of vibratory creation. And in each of those planes of vibratory creation, there would be seven subplanes of vibratory creation. So this is an archaic teaching, this law of seven. Okay, so just So coming back to what Jim and I were speaking about, the idea of the problem of God's contracting universe. So in Carl Sagan's writing, he says, well, now we can trace the universe back to the singularity and the quantum vacuum. So now we know there's nothing mystical about it. And it's like, whoa, that's not right. Actually, those ideas confirm what's been taught in varied mystical teachings concerning the point source origin of the universe and the realms of nothingness and the idea of higher dimensions. So many of these ideas in science, they don't disconfirm mystical or religious teachings. In fact, the new ideas are allowing us more of a framework within which we could understand the mystical teachings. Now we can understand more what the mystics have been saying. So that would be one argument as pertains to what Jim has mentioned, this kind of tale of the problem of God's contracting universe. Jim is actually writing that as a biography about, as he's known me through 30 years, 40 years now, and has kind of seen my development and different subjects we've studied together over that period. So he's trying to give an outside perspective on my life work and how my orientation compares with modern science and other philosophies. And I think more than anyone, Jim, you're really the only one who understands it intellectually, philosophically, scientifically enough to provide that kind of overview. And I really appreciate the work you're doing with that.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to spread that around, though I might be arrested or something. It's funny because the more I read it, the more amazed I am by the content of your work and the scholarship behind it. But as you say, you're quite right about the straw man that when scientists speak of mysticism, they tend to have such a completely erroneous set of ideas about what mysticism says and about the esoteric tradition. They don't really understand it. And so they create these phony arguments about what mystics supposedly say, and then they debunk them, and that's the end of that. But, I mean, it's quite amazing that these otherwise, you know, incredibly intelligent people can be so stupid about this that they just don't have a clue as to what they're talking about. It's quite amazing. The more I read, the more amazed I am by how dumb these guys are when it comes to discussing these ideas. And I guess that's the thing, is that there's no real substantive criticism. Like, if somebody could take apart mystical teachings and esoteric doctrines and really make a forceful argument that made some sort of sense to me, I'd be willing to listen to it. But I've never read one really credible argument about mystical or esoteric teachings. Whereas from the other side of it, like somebody like you who takes this seriously and is familiar with scientific ideas, shows that really these are incredibly rich ideas. Like you said that Stephen Hawking said that hardly anybody, I think he actually said nobody believed in the 19th century, which is even better actually. But I'm just looking at the quote on your website from a conversation that my friend Jonathan Cott had with Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, who's a Kabbalist scholar.
Read that.
And he's talking about Rabbi Kushner says, one dot, a point of light, perhaps the fact that contemporary cosmologists talk about a dimensionless point of light from which all being sprang, and that the Kabbalists long ago came up with precisely the same image in the 14th century. Moses de Leon spoke of, quote, a hidden supernal point whose, quote, primal center is the innermost light of translucence, subtlety, and purity beyond comprehension, close quote, means that this awareness comes from something we all carry within us. And he goes on to talk about we're all walking Torahs in the sense that we're books of knowledge. And, you know, this is in the 14th century. But, you know, you'll never read that in Stephen Hawking's Put Down of Mysticism or Carl Sagan's or Richard Feynman's or anybody, you know. Richard Feynman has a quote, great theoretical physicist and lecturer, said something to the effect that what strikes him about mysticism is that the ideas are too provincial, too local. And then Carl Sagan repeats that same phrase when he's describing his interpretation of religious teachings. He says, it seems to me that the stories that they offer are too provincial, too local, and that the story that science presents is much more spiritual in the sense that it's much grander and much more, it's much richer. But how can people say that when you have something like that from a 14th century Kabbalist talking? You know, there's nothing provincial or local about mysticism at all.
They don't know what they're talking about. They're not knowledgeable of it. Like they take religion simply on a superficial way, seeing different rituals and beliefs that groups have, but they don't consider that. Any of the religions, like I see religion, what the esoteric side of religion is the science of the soul.
Yeah.
In the deepest way, I would say it's like a science of God, like ideas about God and teaching about God and the existence of God and how that divine source is related to ourselves in our soul life somehow, that divine being is the source of our own being, of our own consciousness. So I would say that there's actually like a cryptic language in different religious teachings about ideas about the science of the soul. Like that's why I argue. See, I think the most important scientific issue in the debate between science and religion is the issue of the origin of human consciousness. And all the modern scientists assume that the brain and the material brain produces consciousness and that consciousness is centered in the head, whereas all of the esoteric teachings say our self or our higher self or the soul life are connected most intimately to the heart, and the origin of self-existence emerges through the heart rather than the mind. The mind reflects the light of the self within the heart. So there, Jim, I would say, like, there's a scientific issue. You know, put that on the table. What do we know about the nature of human consciousness? And let's compare the head doctrine to the heart doctrine. There's a scientific issue that bears on this religion versus science issue.
Yeah, and I'd say that.
And the other one was, like, the idea of what you were saying about the point source. I mean, there's a Kabbalist who back in the 14th century, again, was describing the point source origin of the universe.
Yeah. And then you have an experience that Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda, relates about his experience of cosmic consciousness, and he describes how he knows the universe, like he literally is one with the universe as a result of being struck in the chest by his master, and he says he cognized the universe as a point. Imperium, yeah, which is like the fiery realm of the heavens.
Yeah, the seventh heaven.
As an intuitive point in his heart, and
yeah.
he has a detailed, really quite incredible explanation of how really his consciousness passes into the higher dimensions, and so he becomes eventually. He sees the physical world at one point, like he's aware of a vast expanse of space, and he actually can see into matter, like he can see the sap going and running through trees, and he has this kind of omniscience, and then he expands into the heavens, and he sees galaxies being formed and resolving into a sea of light, and he basically witnesses the creation dynamics, and he says that he understands that the material creation is composed of tissues of light, and that God's bliss thrilled through everything. The last Blavatsky's term, but he says something to that effect too. But what's really amazing is the more you consider it, he's describing that he's going deeper and deeper within himself. Like somehow, as a human being, he's rooted into some sort of point source, which is the point source of the universe at the same time. Like there's some sort of identity between, on some level, between his being and that of the universe, which is really, I mean, quite amazing. But when you start to consider that perspective, you realize how many different mystical axioms start to take on such deep meaning, like man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, as above, so below. I mean, there's innumerable different interpretations of things that you can spin out of an experience like that. But that's just one experience that sort of reinforces this whole idea, and one explanation that reinforces this idea of the heart doctrine, that consciousness isn't something generated in the brain, but that consciousness originates in the heart, and it illuminates the mind, like the heart is the sun and the brain is the moon, which reflects the light of consciousness, which originates in the heart. And as you say, that's something that a scientific issue that can be investigated. The problem is nobody knows about it. Nobody wants to look at it, but it's a serious proposition.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, you know, in the Heart Doctrine, I have that segment on Stephen Hawking, and it's so peculiar at one point. Like, he's trying to say, well, we understand the universe back to the singularity, and he talks about how he wants to get rid of the need for us need for God, and if he thinks that if he smears out the Big Bang singularity by applying quantum physics to it, which smears out the singularity, then that somehow resolves this issue. Then we don't need God because we can smear out the Big Bang singularity. But it's like the fact that the universe goes back to a point source and that emerges out of nothingness. I mean, whether you smear the singularity out or not, I mean, it makes no difference in a way. In a way, from a mystical point of view, as something narrows to a point, it expands into the infinite. So you do smear it out. So that's even predicted by mystical teachings, the smearing out of the singularity.
Yeah.
Really. It's completely fanciful that they think, oh, well, now we know it's just a material thing. It couldn't have any supernatural significance. Like, scientists would object to what I've heard referred to as singularity mysticism.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a neat term, because that's what I'm saying. Hey, whoa, don't get rid of the singularity mysticism. That's what you got to learn to understand, this idea of singularity mysticism, that you have a central I, that in some mysterious way you don't understand, you have some kind of zero point, just like a universe emerges from a point source out of the quantum vacuum. Similarly, you have that dynamic as growing from a point source. And it's funny because even if you take a material body and you look back, you look at the timeline of a human body, and at one point that is a fertilized ovum, which is like barely visible to a naked eye simply as a point. So the actual physical body, is what I'm saying, then applies to the physical body, that the whole body, in a way, grows from a point source. It grows from within without, in the growth of the physical body from a fertilized ovum. So there, human being, your body as a quantum system then actually did grow from a singularity or zero point condition. So again, the body of the universe grew from a point source. The body of a human being grew from a point source.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too, because I think John Francis mentioned this, but you know, this is the parable of the mustard seed in the Gospels, and you know, a scientist might read that and just kind of literally interpret, well, he's talking about mustard seeds, but he's not talking about mustard seeds. He's talking, you know, he's talking about something quite different on a different level. And that's the problem. There's all sorts of things in the Bible and all in various holy books and various scriptures which can be interpreted literally or can be interpreted in terms of spiritual significance and it has a completely different meaning. But you need that framework to understand things. I think one thing that you mentioned about singularities, but mystical, what was the term, mystical singularities?
Singularity
mysticism is that I don't think most people using that, probably they would be referring to the idea of like the cosmos, but I don't think most people would relate that to the individual level of consciousness, which is
no,
what's so interesting and so fascinating about your work. derived from Blavatsky and the zero point, is that these zero points underline the formation of all beings and bodies in the phenomenal world. Like everything has the same kind of creation dynamics, which I believe. I mean, I believe that. I don't know that, but I do. It makes such eminent sense when you begin to consider the entire model in terms of a variety of different perspectives from science and mysticism. It's quite consistent. I can't see anything wrong with it, you know. Now, I don't know it, and we need to do further research to try to understand it, but it's a fascinating hypothesis and one that's incredibly logical and reasonable.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's a new way of conceiving of the nature of existence.
Yeah.
Once you grasp it on the deeper level, it is. Like, it's an amazing concept that any living cosmos. So, if I, like, for instance, in front of me, I have a Chesterfield. This Chesterfield doesn't have a zero-point center. It's not a living cosmos. A car doesn't. It's not a living being. It's only living beings have zero-point centers.
Right.
And that center is, in a way, it is the life principle in that living being. And so it is like the spark of the divine, the point source of emergence out of the deeper root principle of creation. So the idea is any living being has such a vital life center, and that vital life center, there's an actual physics to it, that it's rooted into deep space. So, yeah, like as you say, Jim, like I don't think I've heard of anyone in the consciousness literature who conceives that human beings might have a zero point center. Like I say, this is your eye. Like I say, if we had to say a human being has a singular eye, this eye is your zero-point center connected to the higher dimensional physics of your heart. I don't think anyone else in modern science or philosophy is considering that perspective. Have you heard anyone else talk about human beings?
I can't even find anybody who considers the idea that consciousness is anything other than somehow the product of the brain or some sort of parallel with the brain's operation. I at the same time as I've been working on the chapter on your zero point teaching, I've been also sort of jumping ahead because the next chapter I'm going to come back to a chapter on consciousness. So the chapter is entitled "The Most Mysterious Thing in the World," which is what William James called it in the 19th century. And I've been reading again from Conversations on Consciousness, Susan Blackmore's book, which came out a couple of years ago, where she has about 20 of the leading consciousness theorists and researchers in the world in conversation. And she asked them different things about their perspectives on their understanding of consciousness. And a few things come out. One is that there's widespread disagreement about what consciousness is, how it should be studied. But at the same time, there's kind of an underlying assumption that it somehow is synonymous or is the result of the brain's biochemical processes. And repeatedly you find whenever you're reading about consciousness, people say, well, I don't see any other way for consciousness to exist other than from the result of the brain's operation. And then when the brain dies, then consciousness ends. Now, in a way, that's right, but it's profoundly wrong, too. The way it's right is, they don't see any other way because they're locked into a set of assumptions, these scientists and these theorists, about the nature of life and consciousness. That they assume that it's somehow generated on a biochemical level and that it's synonymous with a human being, like it's restricted to a human being. Like they've dismissed the idea of a conscious universe or levels of consciousness, the idea that consciousness can exist apart from the body. That's the critical assumption. And once you do that, then, there is no way for consciousness to exist apart from the brain's functioning. But that's a huge assumption, and it's based on the last 300 years of development of science, And it's really a set of assumptions and conventions which are not based in any kind of proof or any kind of evidence. It's just a bunch of assumptions about the nature of reality. And a lot of them were made for ideological reasons. Like, people wanted to dismiss the idea of spirit and soul and animism. I mean, again and again in this book on consciousness, you hear people talking about how vitalism had been disproved by biology. But again, you know,
I mean, it's simply not true.
It's simply not true. What they've done is that they've established a convention to agree that life somehow magically emerges from biochemical processes, and the same thing with consciousness. Somehow it magically emerges. Now, nobody has the first clue as to how either of those phenomena happen. And, you know, sometimes you'll read biologists will admit that. They'll say, like, we really don't know, you know, and if we're really honest, we really don't know. And the same thing with consciousness. When you really start reading all these different researchers, in moments they'll say, well, we really don't understand what's going on. But at the same time as they express these real doubts, they have these convictions that, you know,
it must be the brain.
It must be the brain. Yeah.
It's just figuring out what part of the brain.
Yeah, yeah. And
what the consciousness is, and they can't figure out either of them.
Yeah, it's so ironic. You know, it's hilarious in a way when you have this other perspective. You know, that there's that great quote in Kenneth Pelche's book about, I think is it the Navajos who think that the white man's crazy because he thinks that consciousness is in his head, and he knows that it's in his heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah,
I mean,
the native teaching.
Yeah, and I as I say, when you question that basic assumption, well, those two basic assumptions, first of all, that consciousness is somehow restricted to the physical body of human beings, and that it somehow is associated or generated by the brain, when you question those two assumptions, then a whole bunch of different mysteries and enigmas and anomalies start to become, you know, you can see them in a very different light. And that's what I think is so interesting about your theory and your position.
Yeah, to me, it's like there's overwhelming evidence for the existence of all these kinds of psychical phenomena. You know, just my own experiences and reading the literature of other serious scientists. I think there's evidence for ghosts, out-of-body experiences, remote viewing, reincarnation. So we need a model of science that can accommodate these. Instead of what the modern scientists do is they simply close their eyes to all those enigmas. So what we need to face them bravely and then try to develop a higher dimensional model of how it could work. And then what we find is that the mystical teachings actually provide a model of these things. You know, we need to draw out what is said in mystical teachings and try to develop it and develop that understanding and bring it into science. But often the critics of mystical teachings would say, oh, but there's no theory. Like, they say there's no theory, or how could you have an afterlife existence? Well, there is a theory, because there's a model that a human being has a physical body, then you have an astral body and a mind body, and those are the three lower bodies, and you can exist in those bodies on the corresponding planes of existence within the astral worlds or the mental worlds. Normally, we live in all three simultaneously, so we can't discern it. But even if the body's taken away, you continue to think and feel and have personal identity and history and be conscious and even have memory. In fact, most people out of their body feel almost exactly the same as they feel when they're in their body, which means that even your normal awareness of being, it was never produced by the body. That was only an illusion. It's like Swami Prabhupada says. He says, yeah, you scientists, You study a man's clothes, and you think that the clothes are what the man is. So, and that's what mystical teaching suggests, that there isn't somehow consciousness emerges within without out of the physics of the universe and comes in. So, and the body is a vehicle. That's what Blavatsky, she calls them vehicles, for awareness and action on a certain plane of existence. but we really have different interpenetrating bodies. So there is a model of it. There is a model of higher dimensional existence. So that's why, you know, I think once science overcomes their dogmatism of the head doctrine and materialist science, then it brings us to try to understand mystical teachings more deeply, because mystics, in a way, are the people. Blavatsky explains how they transfer their consciousness into the nominal realms. So they directly experience the interrelatedness of cosmic phenomena, or they experience higher dimensions of existence through actually transferring their consciousness into these realms. And I think, for instance, Jim, when we take that quote about the Kabbalist describing from the creation from a point, like, how does someone arrive at that idea? I would say it has to be through their own inner experience of it. And that's how they then formulate that. And then, you know, centuries later, science confirms that actually the universe similarly emerged from a point source. But I think that's what the mystics do. They know there's a deeper interconnectedness between the individual and the universe around, because they have direct experiences of it, like Yogananda's experience, where his consciousness expands in like circles to embrace larger and larger volume of space around himself. So mystics have this kind of holographic model of the nature of human existence. And it's only now in modern science that scientists are arriving at similar concepts of how the universe could be holographic. And if the universe is holographic, then in some way the whole is embodied everywhere. So, yeah, the whole is written into any part. And this is like Blavatsky, who says there, the fundamental dogma of the secret doctrine is that there's one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So this suggests that there's this infinite intelligence, or intelligence of the whole, that is latent everywhere throughout the whole. So it's latent in the zero-point fields and in the higher dimensions that we don't perceive. So Blavatsky says there is a correlation and interconnectedness of all forces within the plenum, within space itself. So now these concepts are beginning to make more sense in terms of modern physics. So coming back then, Jim, I mean, they're different. See, I think this, we're going back to the debate between science and religion.
Yeah.
And I remember the Sagan book, like this. Sagan uses the examples. He says, well, you know, we used to believe that God had to tell the flower, hey, flower, open. He actually says that in this book. But now we know about the sun, and we know about phototropism, so we can explain the opening of the morning glory without the sun having to say, hey, flower, open. And then in the same chapter, he goes on. He says, it used to be believed that the angels had to push and pummel the planets. But then Newton developed a theory of gravity. So now we don't need the angels because we have a theory of gravity. Okay. That was another of his examples.
Yeah.
Which is completely fanciful, because no one knows what gravity is anyway.
Well,
that's one of the major mysteries. Blavatsky says gravity doesn't exist. See, in Blavatsky, she denies the existence of gravity. She says, really, gravity is due to the electrodynamics involving the electromagnetic oceans of life. In modern terms, it would be what we would call the zero-point fields of the ether.
Yeah.
So Blavatsky's saying gravity, in terms of the attraction of material objects to each other, does not exist. Instead, she's saying it's an electromagnetic phenomena, and that's the newest idea in quantum physics, is that now they think that gravity, as we understood it, may not exist, but it's a variation on the electromagnetic fields in the zero-point fields. This is the new ideas in modern physics, that the gravity of the Earth is really due to fluxes in the electromagnetic ocean of life. So that curves space-time. So the modern concept of gravity is coming back to more similar to what Blavatsky said. But anyway, in that example, it's like Sagan uses such supercilious kind of examples because he doesn't really consider what religious teachings argue. And I don't think most people within the religious traditions themselves appreciate the significance of, for example, the heart doctrine or of mystical views of creation out of nothingness and so on.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with that. I mean, and, you know, in Sagan's book, The Varieties of Scientific Experiences, which consists of his lectures, the Gifford lectures on natural theology that he gave in the mid-80s, has just come out recently. He talks about at one point about why weren't I should look this up, but it's something to the effect that why weren't the Ten Commandments engraved on a billboard on the moon or something to that effect. Like, yeah, he does. He actually says that. It's like, I mean, and there was a review of Richard Dawkins, the British biologist's book, The God Delusion.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Dawkins is kind of Carl Sagan Jr. in the sense that he's followed in his footsteps. And the guy says that, essentially, I haven't read the book yet, but essentially his Dawkins' quarrel that this reviewer says is he attacks the Christian fundamentalists. And as you say, well, Christian fundamentalists don't understand the mystical or esoteric origins of religion. I mean, I would say that represents a deviated octave in terms of Christianity. Like, I think that those ideas are very far, that fundamentalists espouse are so far from the origins of the religion that they basically have nothing to do with them. I mean, it's just, you know. So the reviewer says that really, though, when it comes to theological arguments, Dawkins just isn't any good at them because he doesn't know what he's talking about, you know. But he has a chapter in his book, which is Why There Almost Certainly Is No God. And, when I come to write about him in my book, I think I'm going to have a sub-chapter, something to the effect, why Richard Dawkins is almost certainly not as clever as he thinks he is, or why Richard Dawkins clearly does not know himself, the universe, or the gods, because, you know, he's just so kind of out there in terms of these kind of his own delusions about what he thinks he knows about religion and religious teachings. It's just, you know, it's the straw man that he's erected and that he's attacking. You know,
it's also, though, the danger in it is it's presented as if it's science.
Yeah.
Like he says, his assumptions and, assumptions, is basically what they are. They're unproven assumptions, is put forward as though it is supported by scientific data and scientific argument. But really, it's not. It's just his opinion. But it's not advanced as such. It's advanced as, like, he's a hard-nosed scientist, you know, to tell you what's real. And then all he gives you is his assumptions and his perspective. And not that that may not be value in that, in points he argues.
He's certainly entitled to his opinion, but he invokes the, and that's what my objection, a lot of what Carl Sagan says, is that they invoke the authority of science as if somehow that science supports these meta-theoretical pronouncements that they're making, which really are just sort of consistent with the materialist perspective, the materialist reductionist perspective that they have. You know, on one essential level, really, the mystical and esoteric teachings are saying that everything descends from a unity. Everything emerges from a unity and passes through a series of different world orders of increasing dense materiality and consciousness, and eventually, you know, we have this world order, the phenomenal world in which the material world in which we live, but everything emanates from you know, this unified source, and when people expand their consciousness or know themselves as part of God, then they resolve that back and travel somehow on some levels to the unity which underlies all of creation.
Yeah, they directly experience that.
And they apprehend it. And this has been going on for thousands of years, and people have been working to develop knowledge of consciousness in the self so that they can realize these experiences. So it's like Uspensky says that really psychology is the oldest science. It's generally assumed amongst educated Westerners that science is a relatively new that psychology is a relatively new science, which was developed in Wilhelm Wundt's laboratory in the 1870s in Germany. And Uspensky says no, you know, psychology is the oldest science because people have been studying consciousness for thousands and thousands of years. And what really strikes me, when I was reading this book, Conversations on Consciousness, like I say, these are supposedly the greatest theorists in the world, the most renowned theorists, is how there are a few allusions to meditation, and some people make passing references to some of the holy books, like to the Vedas, and there's some discussion of mystical experience, but nobody at all shows any familiarity with these ideas. Nobody seems to have any grasp of what they say. Nobody gives any serious consideration to what they say. And nobody subscribes to a worldview which recognizes the legitimacy of these points of view. And that's what's like so shocking. It's that, in a way, it's really bad scholarship. It's really arrogant. I think in some ways it's racist, because, you know, who could believe that a little Indian Swami, you know, from the 13th century BC might know something that a modern scientist doesn't know, you know.
Yeah.
It's not racist in the normal sense of the word, but it's sort of temporal and cultural chauvinism. It's like we of the modern world and we of the educated West are so much smarter than everybody else who's ever existed. I mean, again and again, you read this, like Andrian, who is Carl Sagan's widow, says in the introduction to the Varieties of Scientific Experience that really it's just in the last 300 years that science has overcome all the murky metaphysical past and dogma and superstition associated with religion, and it's only in the last 300 years since the rise of modern science that we've really come to know things objectively. But that's complete nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, but again, it's an assumption, and I, as I say, reading this book on these consciousness researchers, they all subscribe to it. Nobody takes this seriously, like the idea that mystical and esoteric teachings might be a source of something you might want to look into, which is really intellectually unforgivable. The more I'm getting angrier and angrier as I read these things, in the sense that, you know, not really angry, but, you know, it's kind of, I get kind of indignant about the ignorance of it all. And these people are so full of themselves, they think they're so smart, you know, and then they can write books like Consciousness Explained by Daniel Dennett.
No kidding. that was a headache.
Yeah, oh, I was going to say Nosebleed started. That book was maybe the worst book I've ever read in my life, and with the most pretentious title, you know.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame how it's presented as science. It, you know, there's a caricaturization of religion as like supercilious. I can understand why people say it in ways like science is so advanced today, and there's no squabbling with that. That's
no.
not the issue here. Because I would take all the facts of science. What's at issue is the interpretation of the facts of science. It's not the facts of science themselves which belie a mystical perspective. It's the materialist interpretation of those facts. So, as a mystic, I have no problem maintaining my mystical viewpoint, and at the same time have no trouble assimilating or accommodating other facts in science that are quite consistent. Generally, I find that the facts of science are consistent with a mystical perspective. Like, that's even the idea, like the heart, I would say, is the center of the human being. Well, as a quantum system, if you forget the assumption of the head doctrine, but as a quantum system, if physics, and so we're a physical quantum system, the center of a human being is the electromagnetics of the heart, which is estimated as having 5,000 times the electromagnetic volume of the mind in the brain. So as a human being, as a quantum system, the center of life is within the heart. And then there's the enigma of the heart, how the heart generates its own electrical impulse, that nobody can account for that through external causes. Instead, it's said to simply be self-inherent. It's inherent to those cells of the heart, that they somehow polarize and depolarize and generate the heartbeat. So scientists come to a wall where they can't go any further, and they just say, oh, it's just inherent. And they think that's science, then, to just say it's inherent. Okay, but I'm saying it's also another hypothesis, is that it's not simply inherent, but there's a higher dimensional physics to it. Because below the mass of the material heart, you have a mass of unemergent light called the bliss sheet. And there's a higher dimensional physics underlying the physical heart. So it's a serious scientific hypothesis. It's not just, yeah, and it can be considered as such. So then I would say, that's just an example of how I'm trying to say, you know, how the idea of the heart is the center of the human being. And I came across a scientific article I'd referred to before where they're trying to regenerate cells of the body and growing them in cultures. And they find that with other cells of the body, they can culture them and they'll grow. But with heart cells, they couldn't get heart cells to differentiate until they applied an external electromagnetic shocks, which then furthered the generation of the heart cells. Okay, so in the experiment, the researcher ended up having to supply that kind of external hard shock to the cells. So I'm saying there's a higher dimensional physics that does the same thing, that we're only simulating that. So I would say, If you have the kind of mystical perspective, as I've elaborated in my work, drawing from the esoteric traditions, there are many questions in different areas of science which take on new significance and a different way of interpreting evidences. So it's not, yeah. So, and also, if you have this perspective of as embodied in my work, it certainly helps you get a critical perspective on what people ordinarily simply assume to be correct, which is that the brain produces consciousness. But no one can explain what the consciousness is or where it's produced in the brain, and it's completely unexplained, but it's presented that said to be science. But really, it isn't. It's pseudoscience. I mean, it's a viewpoint, but it's not substantiated. And in a way, it's inconsistent with all this other kinds of evidences, especially it's inconsistent with the evidences provided by those mystic explorers of consciousness, the little yogis who meditate on the nature of self, or the shaman who learns how to interact with subtle beings and subtle dimensions. So, that's what modern see. I remember Steven Weinberg, the end of the first 3 minutes where he has his book on creation physics. You know, remember, Jim? It was back in about 86, I think.
Yeah.
And at the end, he says, you know, it's like the universe seems like a farcical chain of accidents. But then he says, but at least we kind of have brave scientists who kind of spend many hours sitting at their desk figuring out how it all works, you know. and it's like, oh, what was my point? Like, it was just funny. Like, how do we approach understanding the mysteries of life and of self? Can you sit at a desk and do it? You know, is that how you go? It's like how the scientist tries to explore the modern psychologist tries to explore consciousness. They explore it by trying to think about it, or they, you know, stimulating the brain or things like, they don't explore it through self-study as it is involved in all the esoteric traditions. and in the all the esoteric traditions say we have to attain to a higher level of consciousness to know self, that we have in the kind of illusory false consciousness system. And we have to attain to this higher experience of self. And there can be different levels to that that we might attain to. But there is such a similarity of teaching across all these different esoteric traditions, especially as pertains to the heart doctrine, and I would say as pertains to the concept of us as having a singular zero-point source, I, that there is an I in the human being. Not an I that's like a modern scientist thing. Oh, it's all in the DNA. And the DNA, but I mean, they're really very immensely complex molecules, and it's all little bits. It's binary information. It's all little bits. So it's not a singular I. You couldn't have an I existing in DNA.
But even that, I mean, this again is like, you know, it's one of the anomalies is that the material of your body is continually being replaced and regenerated. And even the DNA does not last a lifetime. So somehow the information isn't actually in the physical molecules of the DNA. Like there's some sort of underlying...
It's in the field.
The information field, yeah.
It's in the field.
I mean, that's an anomaly that when people talk about, well, vitalism's been disproved, and then by that they mean that the materialist explanation is sufficient. Well, it just isn't. I mean, it's amazing when you read that nobody seems to want to recognize that's a basic paradox, a basic enigma that confronts life sciences. Again, how does life originate? You know, it's like there's some sort of magical process by which life and consciousness are created. But if we need to adopt
that's beautiful. That's nice how you describe it. That some kind of magical process by which consciousness and life are created, and that's exactly what is being said in the mystical tradition.
But the mystical perspective, when you're trying to explain it from the ground up, so to speak, from a materialist reductionist perspective, you're saying it's an emergent property, which basically is a fancy way of saying it just happens, and we have no clue how it just happens. But you know, suddenly life and consciousness emerge from some sort of aggregation of physical molecules. Well, the mystical explanation is much more reasonable, saying, well, it comes down. It exists in a unity, and it comes down through a series of world orders and eventually, you know, through these singularities. Just as Blavatsky explains it, you know, bodies are ensouled, and they're vivified through the light of consciousness. I mean, and the mystical perspective repeatedly explains this. You know, Carl Sagan says in his writings that in the religious teachings, in religions, what you don't find is any kind of consistent claims about the nature of reality or of human beings. And, you know, I started thinking about that, and as you just said, you know, that repeatedly the heart doctrine is through all sorts of esoteric and mystical teachings. The equation of consciousness with light is through all sorts of, in every teaching.
Yeah.
The notion of hierarchy, which is Ken Wilber points out, this is the first generation, or this is the first, in the last 100 years, this is the first time in human existence that any kind of knowledge system has denied hierarchy. That the modern science is the first time that this has ever happened. You know, hierarchy has always existed in human knowledge. It's always been a fundamental feature. I mean, and you can go through, like, you know, I came up with 7 of them in like about 5 minutes, just thinking for 7 fundamental features of mystical and esoteric teachings that recur through all of these things. Well, that the illusion of the physical world and the illusion of the ego structure in human beings, that there's a fundamental reality underlying this, and that we're mistaken as to the nature of our I experience and our soul.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another thing, you know. I mean, nobody deals with the real question of what is the real nature of the I experience. Everybody thinks that they know what the nature of the I experience is, but nobody kind of questions it. You know, they just assume that my I is my I, it's my identity. But you know, they don't go beyond that and try to really question it. You know,
they have some ideas. Like, I know the newest idea is that your sense of me kind of comes from a certain part of your prefrontal cortex.
Oh yeah, yeah.
There was that article in Time Life kind of showing had a little me written up in your cortex.
Yeah.
Where they thought your me experience came from. You know?
Yeah, which, okay, that's an idea. It's but wrong.
I mean,
there might be
aspects of self-experience that involve
that part of the cortex. Is, yeah.
So that's not even the problem.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing is a deeper issue. Like,
yeah.
Although there may be certain kind of me activity up in part of my cortex, especially if I'm thinking about myself or something, that doesn't mean that my experience of me more fundamentally is just that little process up in the cortex. Like, even as I sit here now in my room, I feel me all through myself.
Yeah.
You know, I can. Sometimes it's more in my mind, but at the moment I can feel myself all through myself in the blood in my body. So
yeah.
I have that experience of myself. You know, and so... Yeah, so it's just a much, much deeper understanding of the nature of consciousness and this idea of consciousness being connected to the blood flow. See, there's a scientific hypothesis.
Yeah.
Again, why don't these people want to debate science and religion, talk about the origin and the nature of consciousness and evidence that it's produced by the brain or evidence that it's related to the soul and the breath and the blood and the generation of the heartbeat. That's all said in mystical teachings. It's a scientific idea, the idea that there's a bliss sheath, a mass of unemergent light the size of a small grape within the area of the heart. That's a scientific idea. Doesn't make it right, but it doesn't make it wrong.
Yeah.
It's worthy of being considered if mystics from different traditions describe these inner orbits of the heart. So we want to look at what would the physics of that be. If it's a mass of unemergent light, then at that level of the unemergent light, that level of self within you might illuminate all the patterns of your life, because it's a higher order of light that might illuminate the whole of your life. If you could kind of, that's what happens at death. Maybe your consciousness withdraws into this mass of unemergent light, and as that happens, you have illumination of the patterns of your life. Because that's a realm of light that underlies in yourself, the mind of clear light, according to the Dalai Lama. So individual consciousness is a reflection of the mind of clear light. When consciousness resolves into the heart at death, people do have life reviews, and they have illumination where they can see a whole patterns of their life and things that have happened to them. Even as them all existing simultaneously, so there could be this higher level physics to the heart and what happens at the heart through the process of death. And your heart center is the center. It's the center all the time. Even if you lose your physical body and you're in your astral body, you kind of have your astral heart. You know, it's your psychical level of your heart, and then your mental heart, and then your divine element within your heart. So there's these higher dimensions within the heart, the physical, psychical, spiritual, and divine levels to the heart. And there's a higher dimensional physics to this because we exist in very enigmatic space. Space, like understanding what space it is. For Blavatsky, the ether is sevenfold. And then there's like the higher ether, the seven... skinned eternal parent space, and then there's the lower ether, which he says is generated from the sun, because the sun has seven levels of the lower ether. She calls it the astral light. So there's a lower ether and then the higher ether. So Blavatsky's got this complex idea of how we as beings exist within these ethers of space, and it's all very beautiful. It's funny because, in a way, mystical teachings are so profound. That's the problem, is people don't comprehend it. People think modern science philosophy is so flat. Like, it's just, like, two-dimensional.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I wanted to say that, again, coming back to the consciousness researchers, is that one of the things that really did strike me, every time I read these people, I realize that when you were talking about all this material about the heart, you know, and about how it's rooted into higher dimensions and you know, these higher spaces and everything, it's really striking when you have that perspective, like from your perspective about the heart doctrine. It's really striking how consciousness researchers essentially view human beings as these isolated islands of consciousness in the universe, and that really the not only isolated islands of consciousness, but in the last 300 years, like consciousness and spirit and animism and vitalism and soul have all been denied by science, and this wasn't disproved or anything. They were just banished from the universe. And really, what you wind up with is consciousness is now ensconced in the brain. And when consciousness researchers talk about human beings, they talk about them as if they were just sort of these disembodied brains that you know, use their bodies only to sort of get around and have sex and, you know, feed themselves, but really everything's focused on the brain, and there's no recognition of anything sort of below the neck, other than, you know, occasional references to the spinal column or to the, you know, some subcortical mechanisms in the brainstem. But it's really peculiar when you realize that it's like a snowball, in the sense that a set of assumptions has led them to a certain view, and now it's taken on its kind of this whole momentum of its own, and it's getting farther and farther away from ostensibly what they're trying to study. They're trying to study human beings, you know, which are, you know, allegedly have physical bodies, but you'd never know it reading these people. It's really quite odd when you look at it from, like I say, from the perspective that you're putting forward, that consciousness is arising in the heart, and that, you know, that obviously, like from the fourth wave perspective, that we have multiple brains, you know, in our bodies, and it's really peculiar, you know.
It's very limited. Sure, limited.
It's so shallow, you know. It's so. You know, I was just going to say that, you know, Carl Sagan again. He says that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Yes, and he says in his book, the Demon Haunted World, he has a list of he calls it the baloney detector, and it's a list of different principles in which you can judge extraordinary claims made by people for paranormal phenomena. But as I was reading this and thinking about this consciousness research, really, if you applied Sagan's baloney detector to modern consciousness research, all baloney, you know?
It is, yeah.
Baloney from beginning to end. I mean, there isn't one thing, really, that's established, you know, in terms of with any kind of real certainty. And it's all like this tissue of assumptions, which really is, like in Francis Crick's words, it's a house of cards. They're theories of consciousness. They don't really withstand any kind of careful scrutiny because they're not based on anything.
No.
You know, the other mistake that one of the people in the book referred to this, and it was quite insightful, is that they mistake sufficiency with necessity. You know, that you need to have a brain in order to be a conscious human being, you know, and you need to have your brain operating on some sort of normal level to have normal experiences of consciousness. But that doesn't mean that your brain
is causing
consciousness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a big leap. I mean, and that's it's ironic because in experimental psychology, over the last 7,500 years, researchers have realized how you know, all sorts of assumptions and undetected biases can creep into people's research and contaminate it without them even knowing it. So that they, more and more they try to guard against that, against so-called demand characteristics and experimenter effects, but they don't realize how many of those kind of biases, you know, affect their understanding of consciousness.
It's funny, I see the whole thing now more as intentionally done, that there's been an intentional, it's been a way of weakening humankind as a species, is to undermine understanding of the religious traditions and teachings and create this kind of science-religion dual system. I see it. But yeah, I've learned fascinating things lately just from some internet studies, you know, about how when Truman at the end, 1948, passed a bill allowing the U.S. to bring in like 500 Nazi scientists in the war industries and the rocket research and so on. And they also brought in like 600 mind control scientists. Okay. And they brought these in, and through the past 50 years, the CIA has carried out all these called MK Ultra, all the mind control methods that they've developed that people have no understanding of. They really have a far deeper understanding of a lot of these things than what they've allowed to come out in universities. In a way, I think there's been this intentional kind of deceptiveness of the human race, and this use of psychology has been advanced most in the areas by the intelligence networks and used against people in ways people don't understand that's happening now in our society. And so I see that was a very primary influence in early American psychiatry and psychology, was this kind of behaviorism, and they particularly were interested in the facets of conditioning, and that was so valuable in terms of them, how to torture people and how to brainwash people and how to control people as robots and things like this that they've done a lot of that people aren't aware of. So in a way, I think there's been a deliberate attempt to prevent broader views to come out in modern psychology. And just to use myself as a case, I was driven out of York University and kind of had a case there over academic freedom, which ended up lasting 8 to 10 years. And there was overwhelming student support for my teaching there. But they drove me out in the way through their intolerance of what alternative kind of perspective I was representing and how it challenged what was being taught there. And at the same time that was happening to me, there was Ian Curry, who was a professor at the University of Guelph and had written an excellent book called You Cannot Die, A Century of Research into Death, I think was the subtitle of his book. And he was being driven out. He was driven out of the University of Guelph. And I understand Ian ended up committing suicide at one point. At the same time, Howard Eisenberg, who was a psychiatrist, who wrote the book Inner Spaces, Explorations of Parapsychology. He was trying to look at parapsychology and the new physics. Jim, you remember Howard Eisenberg's book? He was going through all the troubles he faced at University of Toronto. So it was what they essentially did is they got rid of the people who wanted to explore these other areas, and I think this has been an intentional thing as I see it now, and you see it as very, very devious what's happened, and I see it as much more systematic than most people would conceive.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that, but I mean it's kind of like, I don't doubt that that's true on some level, but it's certainly true about the CIA and about the research into conditioning and mind control. I mean, they did the acid research too, you know,
the experimentation.
Trying to manipulate people. And of course, the Soviet Union was deeply involved in all sorts of psychic research too, because they were trying to use it as weapons and
yeah.
you know.
And a lot of, like, microwaving people. I read an article in...
But a whole other level, you know, I mean, if you want to talk about people manipulating people, is that, you know, Lloyd Strickland, the social psychologist at Carleton University, who was my thesis advisor, always used to say that the best social psychologists were the guys in advertising and marketing, because they, you know, in terms of actually predicting and controlling behavior, he said they were light years ahead of academic social psychologists.
Yeah.
Like, they had a very
precise
understanding of how to manipulate consumers, you know.
And through their media. That's exactly what's been done. Like, that's exactly how they've been able to kind of so entrance humankind into not perceiving what is being done in the world.
Yeah, but
yeah,
I mean,
that's how I see it. It's like there's been this intentional mass hypnosis of humankind through the media. They've kind of dummied us down. They've kind of reduced us to a certain lower level that everybody's rendered impotent, kind of, and doesn't know what's happening.
Yeah.
But the media, I turn on CNN and how they, like, this newest shooting, which to me is just another of these hoaxes. There's
You know, I think you should never underestimate the power of maniacs to do things. I mean, things happen, you know, all the time, and it's just it's just kind of inevitable that, I'm not really sure what purpose that would serve to manipulate people. There are all sorts of much grosser manipulations of people. But I wanted to ask you something, because I mentioned this earlier. This is a question I have for you about the development of your perspective in terms of psychology. But when I was writing about trying to explain sort of, you know, how you kind of came to be interested in mysticism and esotericism, like, I mean, originally you had an interest in parapsychology, and then you started studying the fourth way of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and you started to develop an idea about the model of consciousness based on the fourth way teaching. But
I'd say it was the Gurdjieff Uspensky first, before the parapsychology.
But originally, yeah. I think you, the reason why you read you had been reading some parapsychological material, and somebody said that's why they suggested you read In Search of the Miraculous, because I remember, like, you had been reading Paharich, and we had been reading.
It was Paul Isaacs.
Yeah,
mentioned to me as a fellow graduate student in psychology. I was interested in self-consciousness.
Yeah,
that's why. And he suggested, Gurdjieff talks a lot about self-observation,
self-consciousness. From Duval and Wicklund and self-conscious awareness in their work too.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. It was studying some of the social psychology.
Yeah.
But
what I wanted to ask you, and this is what the point I made, which I think this is really interesting in terms of, you know, like, I used to teach, I taught personality theory in Carleton University a couple hundred years ago, and I think one of the things that when I studied to teach the course, that's when I really learned a lot about personality theory, but one thing that really struck me is how different personality theorists kind of had a central idea, or they were really influenced by something which was the zeitgeist of the time. Like, for instance, in Freud, you really have a hydraulic model of energy in his idea about energy cathexis, and that was influenced by ideas in the late 19th century about hydraulics and the closed systems. And then you had, like, somebody like Watson, who wanted to, I don't know if he ended up in advertising. I think he ended up in advertising, actually. But
yeah, he did.
Yeah,
yeah.
He wanted to get rid of kind of all internal phenomena, and that was kind of his main thing. So it influenced his methodology. And somebody like George Kelly, who saw people as acting like scientists, so he just developed the idea of the theory of personal constructs. But what I was kind of getting at was that one thing that really struck me that I thought was so interesting in the way that you developed your ideas was that when you started kind of trying to think about consciousness, is that you sort of quickly came to the idea that rather than trying to understand and prove or disprove all these different paranormal phenomena, like individually. Like, you sort of saw the central question as to whether or not consciousness could exist apart from the body, and you sort of took the perspective, okay, let's assume these things are all real. How is it, would it be possible for these things to be real? Because they're not really possible in our current understanding of things. So, in a sense, you stood the issue of consciousness on its head, eh? Like, by saying, no, consciousness isn't produced in the body or isn't, you know, isn't restricted to the body. Consciousness somehow must exist apart from the body. Like, was there some sort of reason why you took that perspective, or some sort of experience you had, or something that, that led you kind of to, because, I mean, it's quite a radical, you know, interpretation of things. I don't know anybody else who kind of would have made that assumption. You know, I thought it was very interesting when I was thinking about it. Like, yeah, I don't know if it was a gradual thing with you or if it just sort of hit you at one point. Like,
yeah, no, I think it was a gradual thing. I had different experiences of seemingly being out of my body. You know, so I had direct experiences of that, and I'd had different instances of ESP or seeming group mind incidents through my life, and the experiences of like certain states of consciousness where you're in more formless realms,
mm-hmm.
that seem to kind of interpenetrate and not be dependent upon the formless, the form. So it was that, and then kind of studying, you know, with personal experiences, and then studying, you know, near-death experiences was an important area of research at the time, especially Michael Sabom's book, Recollections of Death, I forget the title of it even, but he was a doctor who had been skeptical.
Skeptical, yeah.
And he did a really well-controlled, experiment where, you know, he took so many people with small numbers, 30 people who claimed to have out-of-body experiences during their resuscitation, and 30 people who didn't. So it was relatively small samples. And he had even the people who experienced it were just to describe all the things they had in their memories. And the other people who could recall nothing were supposed to describe it like imagining what you would experience or say, okay? To see if they could just generate it just out of what people might know. Or you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, and then as it turned out, like, there were no major errors made in any of the accounts of any of the people who really claimed to have had out-of-body experiences. But there was nobody in the other group that had any consistency or more than one or two elements that were correct. And then, in fact, almost everybody made major mistakes, that it wasn't at all what happened. So it was just seeing that was a book that really struck me. And then just, you know, then as I explored, and I just saw how many different areas of parapsychological research there was, you know, reading about, like, Rhine's ESP and you know, studying of synchronicities and idea of reincarnations. I mean, there's so many, and I remember reading Uspensky saying that normally in science, everybody closes their eyes to all of the enigmas. And I thought, oh, that's what we need to do. We need to, like, grasp there are all these enigmas. So instead of, let's not make them enigmas. They're not so enigmatic. A ghost isn't so enigmatic to me. It's an entity in a subtle dimension that doesn't have a material body but is lingering around. Like, that, it's not such an enigma. You know, it's a multidimensional universe. So there are, you leave your body, okay, you leave your body. You know? That's okay. It's not an enigma anymore because that's what you are. You know, you're not simply your body. So in a way, it's like I saw the whole mainstream of science, everybody trying to deny there's no evidence for any of this. And all the skeptics, they're like totally superficial scientists. They're not like real scientists, fraud science, because they have a position that's kind of determined, and they say there's no evidences when they don't examine them all, or they just find one element in this and that. And then when they write their books, they make all kinds of fundamental mistakes too, and they're rebutted. And, you know, it's more squabbling. It's like everybody just squabbles about whether or not there's evidence. So I thought, let's forget the issue of whether there's evidence. There's evidence. It's proven, you know. It is. So I just worked from there. So, okay, so how could it work? That becomes the issue then. And then we turn to mystical ideas, which give us different concept of consciousness and I related to the heart, and that there's actually a higher dimensional physics to human beings. So these concepts make more sense in terms of modern physics, of understanding the quantum vacuum and the zero-point fields and the concept of holography, you know, how living beings grow from zero-point sources. So all the matter in the body, it's in a singlet state in a way. So there are these fields of information that sustain us. You know what we were talking about before, your body's hurt. And how do you replace all the elements in your body, all the cells and everything. So there has to be an underlying field or template so that the cells in the liver know to differentiate as liver cells and the cells in elsewhere as other cells, you know. There's an underlying intelligence that pervades the body as a field. So what I'm trying to say, it was a combination, personal experiences and then getting to a certain point and, you know, in reading the literature that, you know, sometimes maybe you can believe other people. Like Sabon seemed a serious researcher, you know, he wrote a sensible book. And then I read the skeptics and often they were the most superficial of all. And their arguments, I find more fault in them in terms of scholarship and being scientific, you know. So, and then you read mystical literature, and these mystics, like, wow, their ideas are profound and deep, you know, deeper than modern philosophy. I mean, in a way, modern philosophy and psychology has made man, it's very simplistic. So we have a mind and a body. You know, and there's no heart, no soul, no consciousness, substantive consciousness. They deny the possibility of higher states. You know, the Scientific American has that article on, you know, the enigmas of consciousness, and the guy talks about the range of human consciousness. And at the one end of his scale, he puts vigilance. Yeah. And then he goes down into coma and death. So the most he could ever be is vigilant, you know. And that's his kind of consciousness continuum.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the idea that there might be a higher dimensional level of consciousness related to our subtle anatomy or the deeper physics to ourselves.
Or even like just the basic idea of a self-conscious awareness that, you know, that when you self-remember, that, you know, that's what I see as hilarious. I mean, that's one thing in the book on consciousness researchers do, is that nobody discusses the idea of the difference between that in the waking state, you know, they just kind of subscribe unthinkingly to the idea that our waking state is just this, you know, this unified, undifferentiated state of awareness, like that there are moments where we're closer to consciousness, as Gert just says, and moments when we're more typically when we're asleep, you know, and that the idea that we can be self-consciously aware, that we can awaken in the moment and realize, oh, I am here, and that somehow this dramatically alters the nature of one's conscious experience. But most people just assume that human beings are self-consciously aware or that they can be at will. And that's, I mean, from the fourth wave perspective, that's completely an illusion and a huge mistake. And when I read that guy's, you know, his characterization of the possible states of human consciousness, I burst out laughing. It's like,
yeah,
that's
for me to be dismal. Vigilant or dead.
Yeah, but it's accurate in terms of the current consciousness research.
Yeah, it is.
So it shows a superficiality of it all. And as you say, I would say that from my study of mystical and esoteric teachings, I think the most profound psychological experiment that you can do is to try to remember yourself. And when you realize that you can't remember yourself, you'll realize it awakens you to a whole different understanding of yourself and the nature of the world. And everything takes on an entirely different light as the more you understand the dynamics of that and what that actually implies about who we are, who we think we are, and you know, the difference between those two.
Yeah. So I did mean that actually there might have been someone who was going to call in today,
oh.
And I meant to just thought of this. I'm going to just give out this number for the U.S. in case 877-876-5227. Yeah, it was John Francis. He was maybe going to call in, and I meant to bring it up earlier when you mentioned his book and that. Yeah, so, well, I guess we've been talking about science and mysticism, study of consciousness. It's...
You know, I wanted to mention one thing about that you mentioned Sabam's book and his work,
mm-hmm.
And I just happened to be reading a little piece about him last night in Michael Talbot's, one of Michael Talbot's books.
Oh, yeah.
And... like when he was doing that study of cardiac patients, those who claimed that they'd been out of their bodies and witnessed the procedures in the operating room, versus those who just had that cardiac experience and didn't make that claim, he recalls talking. And he, as you said, he started out, he was very skeptical about it all.
Yeah.
But he was talking to one of the people who claimed that they'd been out of their body, and the guy had described perfectly the CPR procedures performed on him and everything. And at one point, Sabam said to him, and something about the paddles, and the guy, just kind of using the term for the devices that are applied to the chest when you shock somebody. And the guy said, no, they weren't paddles, doctor. They were two round discs that they put on my chest.
He didn't know the name.
He didn't even, this is quite a while ago before. I mean, now if you watch television, you see it in medical shows all the time. But at the time, it was a relatively unknown phenomenon, and this guy perfectly described what and he had inadvertently slipped and referred to the paddles, and he said no, not paddles, these round discs.
I thought that was really interesting. Also, there's incidents like one reported by, I think it was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's own experience, where she talked to this lady who claimed that when she was out of her body, she happened to notice a running shoe on the window ledge on the outside of the hospital, and it was like 10 stories up or something like that, and you couldn't perceive it from the window, and they were able to actually see, yes, there was indeed a running shoe that had been on the ledge outside of one of the windows.
Wow.
So there was where someone reported something like a factual data, like how possibly could she have known that?
Yeah.
Now, a skeptic would say, well, that's just anecdotal.
You see?
But that's the problem, is you get so many things which are anecdotal. And those anecdotals add up to phenomena, unexplained, make sense in a way. So in a way, to me, you know how they have the law of parsimony?
Yeah.
And the idea is the simplest explanation is the better. Well, to me, it was like the modern skeptics are performing so many gyrations to avoid to avoid accepting all this paranormal research, all these incidents, all these evidences from all around the world. They're kind of like doing such gyrations. It's like generating epi cycles to deal with the structure of the solar system.
Yeah, put the planets
in there. Doing that in a way, the simplest thing is like, wow, what's simplest is just say, we're multidimensional beings. We move through different dimensions. Somehow this involves the physics of the heart. It's a complex science. It doesn't mean we understand it all. We don't want to believe it.
Yeah.
In a way, it's not to believe it, it's to consider it and try to experience it in yourself and understand it as a scientific viewpoint, Try to cultivate your inner being self-awareness.
Yeah, I was going to say earlier that, that when you were talking about that, the facts of science are really indisputable and that we're empiricists. I mean, we're both trained as Western scientists, and I mean, I I don't believe in something because somebody tells me to believe in it or because I have faith in it, but I believe in it if it makes sense in terms of it puts in order the facts of my experience, you know, that it's more coherent. And when that's the great mistake that modern science and psychology makes about consciousness. Like Daniel Dennett says that, you know, he comes around and says, well, you can't study consciousness in yourself. You know, he says that to study it in yourself is hopeless, you know, and I'm thinking, no, to study it you can study it externally by studying the brain and you know, I would say the heart, but it's richer to study it in yourself. There's so many things that you have to study it in yourself, and you have to study it in a certain way in yourself, systematically.
Yeah, that's like as Gurdjieff says too, is you can't just study it willy-nilly way. Yeah, you need some kind of understanding, like some framework of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think what is so valuable, key concepts, is the idea of differentiating consciousness from the psychological function of thinking, feeling, and sensation. That these can provide objects for conscious awareness, but they do not themselves constitute consciousness. So there you see the mistake of 50 years of cognitive psychology that always confuses thinking and thinking about yourself with consciousness. So that's kind of been a major mistake. And then the other idea is consciousness as light, and the idea of like having more consciousness, like that we could acquire more light, like learn to become more conscious through our own efforts to wake up, and that we actually can gain light in this way. So consciousness is light and seeking enlightenment. And then the third idea I think is very valuable is the idea of consciousness as a no-thingness. That it is something that is no thing, like it's not a defined thing with borders, like a table is a table or a tree is a tree. In a way, consciousness is that, like, it's like space.
I was just going to say that.
Object in space. You don't perceive the space, but it's the presence of space as a field that allows you to be aware of all the things in space. So similarly, consciousness is like light in space. And so there's this inner light in space, and that can have different vehicles or bodies for extension and awareness in different levels. But the consciousness as light in space can be there in all these different bodies. It kind of permeates them. And these ideas, even though consciousness is light, like in a way to say that, in a way then, well, what is light and what is the physics of light? You know, this is a scientific hypothesis. It doesn't mean it's true, but it's a way of thinking about consciousness. It's often used by Western writers, eh? Julian James in his book, The Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. He compares consciousness to a flashlight and explaining how hard it is to be conscious of what you're not conscious of, because he says consciousness is a flashlight, so wherever you point it, it seems to be light there. But you're kind of not aware of the whole broader field. So some ideas, and then consciousness being related to the heart and learning to awaken the heart. Like, to me, one of the most profound quotations is that one by Ramana Maharshi, where he says, he defines yoga as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So the center of the, what Gurdjieff would call false consciousness system, or the egoic self, is more in the mind, in the head, whereas the deeper self is related to the lotus of the heart. That's where your deeper self center is. So, I mean, that's beautiful, you know, dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. And then I think once if the heart is awakened in the heart, and you can experience that increased illumination, and it can illuminate higher faculties of the mind. But I think that we need to try to conceive of a human being as having an individual I or self within the mysterious space of the heart. and that this is a serious scientific idea. I'm saying this is a scientific idea. I'm not saying accept this. I'm not saying believe this. I'm saying consider it as a scientific idea and try to understand it, because I think that idea is the basis of all the world's religions, is that there is this higher dimensional nature to the human heart.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, when you were saying about consciousness and thinking. Again, in Western psychologists and scientists, they don't ever seem to recognize that. Well, again, and I go back to the Blackmore book. I mean, she talks about meditation, and she's a meditator. But, you know, there's very sort of little superficial grasp of the idea of how thinking interferes with consciousness. You know, at one point, Carl Sagan says that in a variety of his books, he repeats this idea that it is thinking which is distinctly human, which is uniquely human. And in a way, like, I mean, I there's something to that, but that's not the complete picture in terms of consciousness. I mean, I would say that in many ways, thinking is the foremost obstacle to development of consciousness, especially the development of higher states of consciousness. I mean, that's repeated throughout the esoteric and mystical tradition.
Yeah, especially as pertains to, like, lower mind and, like, turning of the mind is an obstacle to consciousness, yeah. And then it's interesting because in another way, like, the way Blavatsky, she would describe the Buddhic consciousness, I think, as being within the heart, but that human beings in our form, the sixth principle is manas, so mind. So we have this Buddhic consciousness within the heart, but a human being is distinctive in having these higher faculties of the mind that can be illumined by that consciousness of the heart. So it's like it's saying, on the other side, like, that is, you know, the faculties of mind are kind of like distinctively, we have certain faculties of mind that are distinctively human.
But
generally, I mean, that's how I think people do meditation wrong a lot. I think people think that when you meditate, you're trying to still the mind, which you are trying to do. But most people kind of stay in the mind and kind of stop it from, like, to stop the thoughts and that. Whereas I think what you need to do in meditation is be a more experience the blood flow through the whole of yourself and come in experience in your breath. It's said that the five levels of the soul life are connected to the breath, and the lowest level of the breath in the body is connected with that deep feeling of inner peace and just nourishment in the body. So in a way, in meditation, we were kind of like, let's connect to the breath and the flow of blood in the body and that sensation through the whole of ourself. And I think trying to do that, sometimes people have too much of a mental attitude towards meditation. So it stays up in the mind, and then observing your mind, and you observe your thoughts, and, you know, you're supposed to observe your thoughts, and then you start thinking about that, you know. Instead of kind of like trying to deal with the mind so much, have another focus. Be aware in your breath and in the blood flow in your body. And come back into yourself in that way. And then I think you can get to that peace of purpose, all understanding. That's like kind of one level of the kind of soul life in the body. But anyway, I mean, the whole point, I guess, of our discussion today, Jim, is that, like, there's many ideas in mystical teachings which do pose serious kind of scientific hypotheses and ideas, you know, that are really interesting. And it's not that they should be believed in. Like, we're not talking about a belief system here. We're talking about trying to discern the nature and structure of reality and to have a model of existence that can account for all the datum. You know, most people just close their eyes to it all.
Yeah, it's like Stephen Hawking says at one point, you know, I think mysticism is a cop-out. And he says, you know, it's something to the effect if you can't do the math of science, you know, you resort to mysticism. And over again, you hear that idea. And I'm thinking, as I study mystical and esoteric teachings, I try to grasp just your work, which is just a fraction of this immense volume of knowledge, you know. How could anybody ever think that there's anything simple or, you know, easy about this? That this is a cop out. I mean, that's, you know, obviously they don't know what they're talking about. Like, they just completely do not recognize the profound nature of these ideas. And as you say, it's not that they're there to be believed in, but they're there to be examined and to try to weigh them and assess them. You know, I mean, I would say that I do believe in them on a variety of levels, but I'm open-minded too about it all, you know.
Yeah. And I just got a letter, got an email in, and Karen printed out. I'm writing as I'm listening to your show. Here's a question you might want to file away for another show, but let's take it on. What are the various meanings, origins of that zero-point symbol, the circle with the dot in it?
Oh.
Okay, just a couple associations to this. What comes most immediately to me is the beginning of Blavatsky's study of the secret doctrine. And she says, before the author is an archaic manuscript. And on the first page, there's a circle with a dull black, dull background. And then on the second page is a circle with a dot in the center. And Blavatsky says that dot represents the dawn of cosmic differentiation. So the cosmos differentiates from a first point within the circle. So that is one of my primary kind of the symbol of the circle with the dot in it. Another person who discusses it is Avanov. And I can just briefly quote some of Avanov's, a quote from Avanov. He writes, the divine spark is buried deep in every soul. We must leave the physical world of matter far behind and rise to the luminous world above to attain the divine principle of our superior soul. I engraved the symbol of the knowledge of the initiates, a circle with a point in the center. Understand me once and for all. I am speaking from experience. For me, it is not mere theory. All my life has been based on this symbol of the circle with its central point. This center, which is in us, we must find. Isn't that nice?
Wow,
enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So those are two primary kind of associations, like the meaning of the zero-point symbol, the circle with the dot in it. Has it turned up in different ancient mythologies, religions from different parts of the world? I wish I were more studied to answer that. I'm sure it has. I wish I had more time to study that in different traditions. I know in the idea in Kabbalah is the first sephira is established, called Keter. It is depicted as a circle, and often a point. It's said that Keter is a minute dot in the midst of the absolute. So there's a point within Keter. So you find it in Kabbalistic teachings of different points. Dot sephira is also represented as a circle with a point in the center. And I would be very interested in studying. See, much of mystical art is based on the zero-point concept because they're mandalas, so they have a central point. I use most the Star of David as a six-sided figure with as above, so below. You have a triangle burning upwards, which represents spirit or fire, and you have a triangle turned downwards, which represents water. So it's the interaction of the triune nature above and below, and these triangles overlap. And if you put a seventh point in the Star of David, it needs its central point, just like God creation occurred, takes 6 days, and God rests on the seventh. The seventh point in the Star of David is very important. You don't want it to be empty inside, in a way. And Blavatsky ascribes profound significance to this in Volume 3 of The Secret Doctrine, which is a fairly rare book. Next week, maybe I'll read her discussion of this, having the seventh point within the Star of David.
Who was that?
Sorry, Jim?
Who was the question from?
He doesn't want his name to be given.
Okay.
That. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting question, though. I have to do a little bit of research and see. I mean, I hadn't thought that much about that, but that's an interesting answer that you gave, too.
Yeah, it would be interesting to look. I would be interested in looking in Hinduism. Once in one of my shows, someone called me up at one point and told me, yeah, in Hinduism they had the same idea of the point source, and I forgot the term she used in that. Is the dot at the center closely analogous in meaning to the tip of a pyramid? Here, it's just to say one thing here. The more common symbol in modern times that people are familiar with is the idea of the eye in the triangle as a symbol of the Illuminati. And Blavatsky says in The Voice of the Silence, she talks about the doctrine of the eye versus the doctrine of the heart. It says that the doctrine of the eye is for the many and the doctrine of the heart is for the elite. You don't often see the eye and the heart in the pyramid. I don't know. I'm not sure how to deal with that. Is it a physics symbol too? It's not used in physics generally. In astrology, the symbol of a point within the circle represents the sun. And I just finished writing a new chapter for the Divine Mysteries, Jim, about Blavatsky saying how the sun has a zero-point center.
Oh, yeah.
And that is its portal to the sun, which she calls the invisible sun, spiritual sun. So that she sees the sun, just like I was saying, like our material body grows from a point source. So she sees the sun as having a zero-point center. And now it's actually, they also see the galaxies as having singularities at the center. Were you aware of that, Jim?
No.
Yeah, now they
really?
Think that's a new view in physics, is that there might be a black hole in the singularity at the center of our galaxy. And that would be consistent with Blavatsky, because he says any living being, like the Milky Way, is a living being
living as
a whole.
Yeah.
Okay, so it has a zero-point center. So there's another confirmation of that idea from Blavatsky. Okay, we just got a couple minutes here. I have to leave a couple. I'll maybe pick up. I never got to Blavatsky's discussion of 0 points today. We had a broader discussion. But I think we raised many interesting points relevant to this issue of kind of science and religion and gone into some of the teachings of the heart and zero-point concepts. Jim, anything you wanted to get back to? I think we have a few minutes here, but not too. I encourage listeners to visit www.zeropoint.ca. Next week I'll try to open it up earlier for conversations again. I often forget. Jim, thoughts?
To say that it's very interesting. I think it's just, I guess the main thing I see in all of this is that the mystical and esoteric perspective, that the more you study it, the more, at the very least, it's a very useful heuristic for understanding the nature of what we know and what we do not know in terms of modern science, and it casts a light that which is really revealing on modern science and very useful at the very least in that and on that level. On the whole other level, it's useful in terms of inspiring me as a human being to know myself and the universe and the gods. But
they're inspired perspectives. They really are. I think what a shame it is that, like, in modern times, no one you can't go any Canadian university probably and study the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky. Like, you couldn't get that in philosophy or science or psychology or anywhere. Or for instance, Gurdjieff's teaching.
No.
You know? And we've studied these alternate systems of psychology. And instead of, you know, they're clearly deeper and more profound than any of the theories that, like, of Freud or Adler, or social behaviorism and behaviorism, yeah. and Adler and Jung and any of these people. Like, they're much, much deeper theories. And yet all these other theories have value, too. All of these, you know, all of these theorists in modern, the people we've mentioned, had value in what the pieces they offered. But in terms of a deeper understanding or a way of trying to understand yourself and your multidimensional nature, these other theories are really quite superficial and only deal with the material aspect. So, okay, well, we'll be back in 2 weeks, Jim. I hope we're still all around. I hope the lunatics haven't started a new war and start off using their nuclear bombs and pointing. My goodness, I can't believe all the deviousness and things out there in the world, eh? Did you see that guy John McCain sing his little song?
No.
Did you not hear about that? About him singing? Oh, he thought it was a funny joke. He sang to the tune of the Beach Boys' Barbara Ann song.
Bomb, 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 bom
of mass murders for a while.
Yeah.
Like, how sick. I can't believe some of it. People don't see the pathology of
yeah.
it.
For a guy who, for a guy who spent 5 years in a prisoner of war camp, you'd think he'd be a little bit more sensitive to the horror of war.
Yeah.
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 That's pathetic.
There's some pretty major things happening. I don't know. Some signs of hope maybe a bit in the States, you know. Pick away at these lunatics. I don't know. Anyway.
All right. Well, thanks.
Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. Remember yourself. Thanks for tuning in. This is Zero Point. Thanks, Don and Doug. BBS
yeah,
Radio. Lots of material archived there. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Great.
Goodbye.
Thanks, Chris.